Continuing in mitzvah, Tavchah 420, the mitzvah of reciting the Shema, central precept of Judaism. Mechein minyan a mitzvah, masha amru. One thing that Chazal told us about Kriya Shema, Shakuriya Shema, tzorich lehashmiya leozno. This is a very important central principle in Jewish prayer in general, that one is required to say the Shema loudly enough that one can hear oneself. You don't have to say it louder than that, but just for the minimal amount that one can hear oneself. Im lo hishmiya l'ozno, aval mikol makom kora hadvarim bisvasav, yotza b'dieved. Meaning, that's only l'chatchila, that you have to be able to hear yourself. The minimum requirement is that your lips have to say the words, even if you can't hear it, which is opposed to a havdil in other faiths where sometimes they pray just by thinking. You get down on, you know, your knees and you just pray in your thoughts. In Judaism, can meditate and you can ask things of God in your head. That's totally fine. But in Judaism, we have specific halachic obligations of prayer, not just communing with God. So therefore, you must recite the davening with your lips. And we, of course, have different... Yeah?
Yeah, I'm not saying from Shimon Esrei, you're out here, you get to that probably. For Shimon Esrei, you should say it loud enough so you can hear it, but not anybody else.
Oh, so in Shimon Esrei, there's a maximum. In Shema, there's no maximum. Okay. In Shimon Esrei, you're supposed to say it, you're supposed to say it loudly enough that only you and no one else can hear it. But for Shema, there's no such halacha. I mean, you shouldn't disturb others. I mean, there are different styles and different shuls. That in some shuls, people daven more loudly than others. So that's okay. Either the whole shul has to decide we're all going to daven really loud, or we're all going to daven quiet. What's disturbing to me, at least, is I don't mind davening a shul. If everyone's screaming and there's, you know, a din, that's fine. But if people are davening quiet and all of a sudden one person in the audience goes, Vilosa suru achare leva... Okay, that's... What just that? That's...
God, he's old, but he's not deaf, you know, right?
Right. So that's a little bit of a problem. That reminds me of when I was the rabbinic intern in Highland Park, and there was somebody who was there from an Israeli... I was eating at one of the Balabatim, and there was a fellow there from an Israeli kolel. There was a coming to America for a few years to teach Torah. So he asked me about the synagogues in Washington Heights. So I said, well, there's a lot of German Jews. And he said, what, do you like the davening? Yeah, you know, it's not, well, there are things I like about the davening. It's very orderly, very whatever. He says, I don't understand how anyone could daven in a Yekes Shishol. I said, why? He says, he's talking to me in Hebrew, but it was translated. He says, what happens if you're in the middle of Ashrei and you're davening and all of a sudden you get so inspired you just have to scream out, Poteach et yadecha umasbia lichol chai ratzon. I said, well, so if you don't do that in such a shul, that's just not part of the decorum. I don't understand anyone could daven there. Okay. I said, I don't understand anyone could daven in a shul where people all of a sudden scream in the middle, Poteach et yadecha umasbia lichol chai ratzon. Okay. But so Yehishmei Rabba is a separate halacha. Yehishmei Rabba, you are supposed to say as loud. I mean, there are different interpretations. The Gemara says, Kol ha'ome ona Yehishmei Rabba mivarech b'chol kocho korin lo gzardino, that your decree of bad judgment will be rescinded if you recite the Yehishmei Rabba with your entire might.
Uh-huh.
So what is your entire might? So two different shittas in every shonim. Some say it means with all your kavana.
Yeah.
And others say it means with all your loudness. So that's why a lot. That's one thing where I'll make an exception. If you want to scream, if you want to scream Yehesh Meraba, so then that's okay. But the other things in the middle of that, and again, if it's not the culture of the shul, there are places where people scream everything. If you go to certain Hasidic shuls, so everyone says everything in a really loud voice. Okay, so that helps kavana sometimes. But you have to. It just depends on the culture. Yeah.
Now, once in a while, you come across somebody who, during the repetition of Shimon Esrei,
yeah,
says the whole Shimon Esrei, you know, out loud.
What do you mean, during the repetition?
No. He's not the Shleif Tzibur.
Yeah.
Somebody's going around and just is saying the words together with the Shleif Tzibur.
All the words or just some words?
All the words, not just something like Kedisha.
What do you mean, because they didn't daven already? Or they daven already and they're not saying it again?
No, it's just that they like, you know, because they like the Chazanas or something like that. You know, whatever. That's not correct, is it?
People have this idea in contemporary Judaism that if you don't say it yourself, it's like you're not so religious, you're not like Yotzi the thing. Oh, uh-huh. So that's why in classical Judaism, many things in the davening were recited by one person and everybody else just listened. And in times of the Rambam, the way he describes, for example, reciting Birkas Kriya Shema, is that the Chazan says the entire Birkas Kriya Shema out loud, and the congregation just listens and answers the Kaddosh, the Kedusha part, answers the Kaddosh and Baruch, and they answer Amen to the Brachas. And of course they say the Shema themselves, that you're not Yotzei with the Chazan. But nowadays people are like, what? You know, in Hallel also, that's also just this morning we said Hallel. So the classical way of saying Hallel is, even if you don't recite the whole thing, you're not Yotzei the whole thing with a Chazan, but you can be Yotzei parts or all of the Hallel with a Chazan as long as you take an active part in the responses. So, for example, that's how we get this idea when you get to the Hodu Lashem Ki Tov Ki Elam Chasdo. So originally, the way it would be is the Chazan would say Hodu Lashem Ki Tov, the congregation was responding the Hodu Lashem Ki Tov Ki Elam Chasdo. Then the Chazan would say Yomar Na Yisrael Ki Elam Chasdo, and the congregation would just respond Hodu Lashem Ki Tov Ki Elam Chasdo without reciting also the Yomar Na. So now because they'd be Yosei just by listening with the Chazan the Yomar Na. So now people think, oh, that's weird to be Yotzei with a Chazan, and so therefore, they say Hodu Hashem Ki Tov Ki Elam Chasdo Yomar Na Yisrael Ki Elam Chasdo. They say themselves the Yomar Na. So we have this tendency in contemporary Judaism for everyone to say things for themselves. We have the same thing by Zimun, that the real way of doing a Zimun is that one person says the benching out loud, and everybody else just listens and answers Amen. So this is taken to extreme in a lot of Chassidish communities where people are not Yotzei anything with someone else. They always say everything for themselves. Everybody makes their own Kiddush. Some make their own hamotzi. One thing I've never seen is that everyone makes their own havdalah. I don't know why. For some reason, that they're okay with being yotzei with someone else.
First of all, they're doing but, it
it takes too long. They want to get it at home too.
No, even at home. So I've never seen ever make their own havdalah, but even you should. So there's some times where I've gone to see the shalom, so they. Maybe they slur the words in Kiddush, or they don't pronounce it clearly. So I'm glad they have the minhag that everybody makes their own Kiddush, but I don't have to be Yotzei with the Baal HaBayis. So, but then, when it came to Havdalah, if I was staying there the whole Shabbos, wait, no, I want to make my own Havdalah. Why aren't you offering me to make my own Havdalah? But okay, that's how it is. So by Kriya Shema, again, so the Kriya Shema, you do have to say it loud enough for yourself to hear, and there's no maximum. You shouldn't disturb others, again, and if that's not the norm in the shul. But that's how loud you should do it. V'chein ma she'amru she'tzarech ledaktek ba'osi osea. That by Kriya Shema, I mean, the poskim extend this to the rest of the davening as well, but by Kriya Shema in particular, there's an inyan that one should pronounce it very carefully, more carefully than one pronounces other things. So, for example, the poskim recommend that, for example, if you aren't careful about distinguishing between a shvana and a shvanach, again, the classical, very stark distinction between a shvana and shvanach, I personally am not a little skeptical of, but nevertheless, I'm just repeating the classical formulation is that of something that you should be more careful about in Kriya Shema than perhaps you might otherwise. That's why sometimes you hear in Kriya Shema, people, you may be saying their negation, more vayu hadvarim ha'el. Those letters have dagesh in it, so it's supposed to be extended longer than regular letters. Again, that's but since in English we don't have as a regular feature, we don't have geminated consonants. I didn't have many in European languages as well. So in general, we're lax about that. But some people like to be careful about it in Kriya Shema. It's not that it's totally absent in English. We have some geminated letters. What? How do you say that something is not necessary in English? What's one word?
Unnecessary.
Yeah. So a lot of people, if they're talking very fast, maybe not. But we have unnecessary as a geminated consonant.
What does that mean?
Unnecessary means it's pronounced longer. You don't say unnecessary. You say unnecessary, and you don't say unnecessary either. You just.
It's spelled with two N's.
Right, but in English, being spelled with two letters does not indicate that you pronounce the letter longer, like the word letter. You don't say letter. You say letter. It's just a spelling convention in English that indicates that the preceding vowel is a short vowel rather than a long vowel. If it were L-E-T-E-R, it would be leader. But you have other languages, many languages as the case, it's just a spelling convention. But in Italian, for example, you have a word that's spelled with two letters in a row, so you actually is a geminated consonant, so you have it is pronounced longer.
Piazza,
exactly. It's pronounced longer. Ah. Fratello, brother, means the L is actually longer than other...
The British do actually pronounce it like bread and butter. Yeah, butter.
They don't say butter, butter. Okay. They say... In American English, we have... we pronounce the... When a T is between two vowels, we pronounce it more like a, what we call a flap in phonetics. But in British English... In British English, right, they don't do that. They say the T clearly, but it's not longer.
Oh, okay.
It's not... Anyway, okay, so that's some people like to do that. Some people like to say in Kriyat Shema, they like to say ayin, they like to say het, so you shouldn't be the same. Again, at a certain point, though, it gets to the where you're just combining different features of different Hebrew pronunciations, you're not being consistent. So if you're saying ayin het already, but then you're saying Ashkenazi suf, so what is this? This is not Ashkenazis. This is a new thing, but since you could argue that since these akpadis are mentioned explicitly in the poskim, so it's okay to shtup them into an Ashkenazi pronunciation. Okay, but most people don't distinguish, even if they're in Kriyat Shema, if they're doing ayin and chet, they don't distinguish tes and tof, like teimanim do, that teimanim say for tet, they say tet. It's like a deeper t. Okay, but whatever it is, there is perhaps a limit, but there is an inyan to be more careful when you recite Kriyat Shema than other things, although we should be somewhat careful for the entire davening. V'imlo diktek b'hayin yotza. But if you didn't do this, you just pronounce Kriyat Shema normally, like any other Hebrew recitation that you do, then you are yotze the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. V'amar min ha-mefarshim, she'ein ha-inyan shelo yazkir ha-tevos v'ha-osios. This doesn't mean... That diktek b'osiyoseh doesn't mean that you have to say all the letters. Obviously, you have to say all the letters. If you miss a letter, then you're not yotzei. Shebezev vade lo nemar sheim lo diktek yotza. Shekol shelo korek Kriyat Shema kulo lo yotzei dechavosu. You have to say every single part of Kriyat Shema, or you're not yotzei the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. Aval inyan lo diktek hu shelo nosan revach bein hadvekim. So, for example, we have, if a word ends, if you have a set of two words, and the first word ends with the same letter as the second word begins. So then you're not supposed to say, here he gives an example, b'chol levavcha. So you're supposed to say, b'chol levavcha, u'v'chol nafshecha. You're not supposed to say, b'chol levavcha. B'chol levavcha, it sounds like you're running the two words together. So you're supposed to have a distinction between the two words. Esev b'sadcha. Wait a minute, what? That doesn't start and end with the same letter. Yes, it's written the same. Esev besodcha, but one is a vase. Not that such a letter is a vase, but whatever, bear with me. One is a vase and one is a base. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? Okay, you could say it's close enough, no. Somebody, there was a famous Semitic scholar in the early to mid 20th century who was the academic Rebbe of the Sri De'esh. It was a very fascinating figure. You should read the biography. Every modern centrist Orthodox Jew should read Between the Yeshiva World and Modern Orthodoxy, The Life and Works of Rabbi Jechiel Jacob Weinberg. Whatever. So he, Mark Shapiro. So excellent. It's an excellent book. So the Rebbe of the Chazon of Sri De'esh was named Paul Kala. And Paul Kala wanted to prove from this statement of Chazal, which is quoted by Sefer Chinuchir, that in the times of the Tanoim, there was no beis and vase. It was all vase. Uh-huh. And it was all, as he says, in those times, they said, Esev visodcha. And then he continues, Vavatem mehira. Okay, we understand two mems. Bechol levavchem. And we have the same issue. Hakonof pisil. So that's also two different sounds. Why would there be any concern that you would run it together? So Kala wanted to argue that it means that it says that in times of Chazal they used to say Hakonof Fisil. That there was no Beis Gimel Dalet Kaf Pei Tof. It was always Beis Gimel Dalet Kaf Pei Tof. Most scholars strongly disagree with this. This doesn't make any sense. There's not really any evidence for this other than this. But it's still somewhat difficult why Chazal would have enumerated these things when there's really no concern that you're going to run it together. Hakonof psil. It's obviously going to be two different sounds. But okay, they're pronounced in similar places in the mouth, and maybe you'll run it together anyway. V'chein, what's another thing that Yotze only b'diavad? Shelohitiz zayin de tizkeru. Lima'an tizkeru. You're supposed to say, you hear this all the time in Kriyashma. You're buzzing at the end. When people get to the end of Kriyashma, they say, lima'an tizkeru, that yitzarich shalat tizach. As I'll tell us, that we have to pronounce the zayin very clearly. Why? It shouldn't turn into lima'an tizkeru. Yeah. That we have a linguistic phenomenon that we call voicing assimilation. That we have a tendency, we mentioned last time very briefly, that there's a difference between voiced and unvoiced sounds. That means whether it's pronounced with the vibrating of the vocal cords or not with the vibrating of the vocal cords. So if you put your hand here on your throat and you say, and you switch between S and Z. So go, the only difference between the sound S and Z is whether your vocal cords are vibrating when you say it. Otherwise, the sound is exactly the same. So the cuff is an unvoiced sound. Your vocal cords are not vibrating. The equivalent to the unvoiced cuff is the voiced gimel. Gimel and cuff are the exact same sound. The only difference being gimel and cuff is the exact same sound. The only difference being this feature that we call a voicing, meaning the vibration of the vocal cords. So
gimel.
There.
Gimel. I can feel something.
Yeah. So the concern here is that the unvoiced cuff will have an impact on the voiced zayin, and you end up pronouncing both unvoiced, and you might say lema'an tiskeru. So what is that? In other words, they were supposed to mean in order that you remember. But what does lema'an tiskeru mean? In order that you receive a reward. Meaning that if we say that in Krishna, it sounds as if we're only doing the mitzvahs because we want to receive a reward.
Very interesting.
Which is not completely the opposite. You have this issue in Halal also in the morning. We might have heard the Chazan say, Ki le'olam chazdo. We have the same thing, because Dalet is voiced and Samech is unvoiced. So the samech tends to turn into a zah when it is in contact with the dalet. So that's why some chazanim, you should be careful in Krishma, I'm not Krishma, in Halal as well, to say ki le'olam chasdo. Takes a little bit of thought, but okay. O shelo herich bedalet. Again, another part is that it's supposed to say ehod. If you don't say ehod, then you yotze b'diavad. Whew, Ashkenazim. Vish and Svardim. Taimanim, again, still say valid, and while some Iraqi Jews, I believe, and maybe some other small communities. Kefi aroy lechatchila lasos hakol. But lechatchila, again, you're supposed to be very careful in Kriyashma to pronounce all the letters very carefully.
Excuse me, does this apply to Kriyashma Lamita or not?
That depends. First of all, you definitely should lechatchila. The main application of these halachas are when you are yotzei the mitzvah of Krishma. So Krishma al hamita, you're not yotzei the mitzvah of Krishma, just for protection when you go to bed, just to be the last thing you say. Also, chas v'shalom, in case one dies during one's sleep, so the last thing that one says should be a Krishma. That's the Krishma al hamita is not, unless you rely on Krishma al hamita, if you daven Ma'ariv early and you didn't say Krishma at the proper time, so some people rely on the Krishma Lamita to be Yotze Krishma at the proper time after Tzeis HaKochavim. So if that's the case, then you definitely have to be Makbid on this. But technically speaking, again, the main application of this is when you Yotze the Mitzvah, but it's proper always in davening in general to be careful about these things, and also it's not good for your own relationship with Krishma if you don't always do it in the proper way. Then you're going to start to get lazy, and you think you're not going to be able to switch it off in your head to make the dissonance between now I'm yotz the mitzvah. Whenever you say Krishma, you should be in the habit of having the proper kavana and pronouncing it properly. Yeah.
What are those people who say Krishma actually sing it with a trop?
That's good. The Shulchan Aruch says lechatchila you're supposed to say Krishma with a trop. V'chein me'inyan ha-mitzvah ma she'amru she'adam shoel bishlo mishu chayev lechabdo u'meshiv shalom lechol adam bein ha-prokim. So between the paragraphs of Krishma, such as between the first and second, or between the second and third, or between the brachas, then you are allowed to ask somebody who you require to honor how they're doing. And if somebody asks you how you're doing, you're allowed to respond. So we think this is really weird, But in the times of Chazal, apparently people used to get super offended if people did not respond to greetings. And greeting in general was a much more significant thing, that you have Isur She'ela Shalom by an Ovel, that when someone's in mourning, you're not allowed to ask that person, that person's not allowed to extend greetings and to receive greetings. So it's a Shaila whether you're allowed to say hello. Is that really a greeting, or is this greeting saying Shalom Alecha, and you're expected to respond? Okay, whatever it is. But the you are technically allowed to respond to greetings to anyone between the paragraphs of Kriya Shema. And you are allowed to actively go ahead and greet someone if you're required to honor that person. And that if you're in the middle of a paragraph of Kriya Shema, then you're only allowed to greet someone whom you must fear, like a king or a major officer. But you're allowed to respond to greetings to anyone whom you require to honor. The Yesh Mefarshim Yiras Oviv, that you don't even need such a, like a king, that it would be even your father that you require, mother you're, that you require to fear. O Rabbo Shalom Chayav Li Ramam, that you're allowed to be even to initiate such greetings during Kriya Shema. So the exceptions to this rule, what's not considered Bein HaPrakim, not considered Bein HaPrakim is between the last paragraph of Shema and the bracha afterwards. So you're not allowed to be mafsik between Hashem Elokeichem and MS for any reason, as a pikuach nefesh. And also, even though we say that in the middle of a paragraph, you're allowed to initiate and respond to readings under certain situations, you are not allowed during the first pasuk. First pasuk of Shema, you are not allowed to greet or not greet, except it says that during the first pasuk of Kriya Shema, afilu melech Yisrael shoel bishlomo al yeshivenu, that even if the king, the Jewish king, is greeting you, you should not respond during the first pasuk of Kriya Shema. So why does it say a Jewish king? Because a Jewish king would understand. You say, sorry, I was saying Shema. You know, I really wish I could have greeted you. You know, hello.
Right.
But if it's a Goyish king doesn't understand Kriya Shema. So the Goyish king is saying, you didn't greet me? I'll kill you. So it's considered pikuach nefesh not to respond. So that means, obviously, if the king is in a position to kill you. But contemporary constitutional monarchs would not, if the Queen of England greets you and during the first pasuk of Kriya Shema, you should not respond. Okay. Kama shelo ra'inu So this was the culture in the times of Chazal, that people were very into greetings and really were distraught by not having their greetings responded to. But nowadays, we're a little bit more chillaxed. We're more used to people, you know, saying, in the middle of davening, you know, I can't talk to you.
But shouldn't people, I mean, if you're talking about a shulsu, shouldn't people be aware that davening is going on and that's not the place and time to
greet
people?
That'd be very nice, and they wouldn't talk out in the hall.
Well, you could say Kriya Shema. There are situations where you say Kriya Shema at home or in the middle of the street I don't know what. Like a lot of times. So on the Friday nights, shul, so we daven a little bit early, so I have to be Kriya Shema, so I want to save time when I get home, or I will be distracted when I get home with the kids, the family, preparing the meal, whatever. So if I don't have guests and I'm walking home alone, so a lot of times I say Kriya Shema on my walk home on Friday night. Mm-hmm. So there, it's possible someone could greet me and not realize I was saying Shema.
Someone saying Good Shabbos to you.
So technically speaking, so you'd be allowed to respond Good Shabbos in the middle of between the paragraphs of Kriya Shema. So one can also make the argument that if you're not saying the brachos and anything, so then there's less of a problem to be mafsik. So maybe even nowadays you could respond. Okay. But nowadays, again, the culture is that we do not respond to any greetings, or certainly not initiate any greetings during the recitation of Shema. V'yesa rube dine ha-mitzvah, there are a lot of other halachos that relate to the mitzvah of Kriya Shema. V'chol anyonim shemivatlin b'shvilan Kriya Shema, there are things that exempt one from saying Kriya Shema. So, for example, the Mishnayos talk about people who are involved in burials. Mm-hmm. At the Chevra Kadisha, if they're involved in a burial at the time of Kriya Shema, then they are not required to say the Shema. They are exempt from the mitzvah of Kriya Shema. If there's someone to take over for a few minutes, so then they have to. But if they're the only show in town, they don't have to say Kriya Shema. Yeah.
Is there any restriction on what you can say in the presence of a mace?
Yeah, so you're not supposed to recite Krishma in the presence of the mace. You're supposed to turn around or be marchik arba amos because there's a problem of loeg la rush. They're not supposed to perform mitzvos in the presence of dead people because it's like you're being insulting to the dead person that, oh, I'm still in the in this world. I get to fulfill mitzvos. You no longer have to fulfill mitzvos. So even though... Right, so when you go into a cemetery, so you're supposed to tuck in your tzitzis. If you're of the persuasion of wearing your tzitzis out, you're supposed to tuck them in at that time. So even though the person is in Olam HaEmes, and it's, in some ways it's a better place than this world... But the one thing about this world that is better than the Chazal tell us that doing mitzvahs in this world in some ways is better than the entire Olam Haba, because out of your free will you get to show your service of God, which can't in the Olam Emes. You no longer have free will. You're just purely spiritual. You're not performing mitzvahs. So you're not supposed to say Krishma, you're not supposed to do mitzvahs in general in the presence of a dead person. So the question is, so a lot of people go to the cemetery and they say Tehillim. So how are you allowed to say Tehillim?
That's not a mitzvah.
It's learning Torah or davening.
Is that
so
learning Torah?
Sure.
Is that
it's part of the Bible.
Oh.
So the... So how can you do that? So the answer is that most people say that if it's for the explicit honor of the dead person that you're visiting, so then you are allowed to say the Tehillim. There's also another thing that the Mishnahis talk about, which we don't really do nowadays, which is that it says that a chosin on the wedding night is not required to say the Shema. Why? Because he's so nervous about what's going to happen, that if you marry a besula, someone who's never been married before, so then there is
performance anxiety. You know.
Okay. Well, maybe he's been married before, so he doesn't have. Okay. He knows what to do, but there is a concern. He might be very nervous that she will not be found to be a virgin, and then he will have to start the legal proceedings. He'll have to start the legal proceedings. So that's he's very nervous about what he's going to find on the wedding night. So according to that, those thoughts are so preoccupying his head that he will not be able to have the proper kavana and grishma, so therefore a chassan between the wedding and the consummation of the marriage is exempt from grishma. This is another thing that we are not knowing nowadays, that we say, well,
so
some are not, so but you have to know. If you're not marrying a virgin, so then it doesn't matter. So you're right, so the Hanami. But the... either because she's been married before, or she's a Baal Teshuva, whatever. There could be different
not
reasons.
Not all Baal Teshuva.
What?
Not all Baal Teshuva.
That was not at all my implication that I meant that it's very likely that if a young woman has been in college, and then in college she did, through Hillel or whatever, she becomes a frum, it is very possible.
Not
these
50
days,
years ago.
Not
right.
In ancient times.
Not 50 years ago.
Right.
It's not
so okay. Bad. Okay. Again, obviously
some
there.
People
are,
did survive public high school.
I'm just saying it's somewhat likely. It's obviously not certainly the case.
Or if she was from and she did something she shouldn't
have
done.
There are people who make mistakes.
She's a Baal Teshuva. Okay?
No, there are people who make mistakes and then they repent and whatever. But whatever the case may be. That would obviously even be according to the halachas recorded in the Mishnah. So the chassan would be required to say Kriya Shema on that night. Okay. So Yisbaro bebrachos beprakim arishonim. This is all explained in the first chapters of Maseches Brachos, which discuss the mitzvah of Kriya Shema. Benoheges bechol makom ubechol zman. And this is applicable in all places and all times. Ah, bizcharim of alo binikevos. The mitzvah of Krishma applies only to males. The fishi bichal mitzvah sasesha is man grama. It's a time bound positive commandment. It's a positive commandment that's performed only at night and in the morning. Okay? So it's time bound. Shanoshim puro. So women are exempt. So wait a minute. Why should women be exempt? Let's think.
I thought women are not exempt from Krishma.
Women are exempt from Krishma.
They are.
But so why should this be the case? The whole point of Krishma is to accept the yoke of heaven, which seemingly should apply to both men and women. So that's why it's interesting that for the mitzvah of Krishma, the poskim recommend that women voluntarily perform the mitzvah in much stronger terms than they recommend regarding any other mitzvah, saseh, shahazman, grama, shofar, which is very interesting. No. Even more strongly than shofar, yeah. Shofar, really, women really should do because it's become sort of like a minag, that women have all accepted on themselves a mitzvah to hear the shofar, even though I think, again, technically it's not required. But for Krishma, it's very recommended that women should recite at least the first pasuk of Krishma in morning and evening. Although again, I can't say it's obviously I can't say it's absolutely required, but it's very strongly recommended that if a woman is again, a lot of women do triage with their davening.
Yeah.
So they don't have time for so much. So things that women are absolutely obligated to say are Birkas HaTorah, Birkas HaShachar, and Shmoneh Esrei.
And Nachma.
Nachma. So that's obviously the first priority. But if anything else is going to come into play, so the poskim strongly recommend that she should insert at least the first pasuk of Shema and the bracha after Shema, which mentions Yetzias Mitzrayim. So obviously, if she could say the whole thing, that's even better. But yeah.
Okay. So if talking about, Shmoneh Esrei.
Yeah.
What are the circumstances where you're allowed to say Shmoneh Esrei sitting down, like a plane that people say now? In fact, you can, you know. What's the.
When are the circumstances when you can have better kavana sitting down? Will you be less disruptive sitting down than you're allowed to daven sitting down?
Okay.
Over al ze velo kara kriya shma b'chol yom v'chol laila bizmana shekavalu chacham. If you violate this mitzvah and you didn't read kriya shma in morning and evening, b'tel asay ze the Ramban zal mana v'chesh mitzvah kriya shma b'yom mitzvah achas v'laila mitzvah acheres. The Ramban says that they're two separate mitzvahs: the nighttime kriya shma, the daytime kriya shma. They're completely separate times. They're totally separate occurrences. Mitzvah Tav Chaf Aleph 421, my favorite mitzvah. Mitzvah's Tefillin Shel Yad. Actually, maybe the Rosh is my favorite mitzvah. Whatever, Tefillin is my favorite mitzvah as a sofer. So now we're going to get, this is very exciting for me.
Oh, so these are two separate mitzvahs then?
Yes, definitely. we'll get to that. Why it's this two separate mitzvahs here. Like, sure. The two tefillins. Tefillin Shel Yad is a separate mitzvah from tefillin Shel Rosh. Shalikshor tefillin al hayad. To tie the tefillin on one's hand. Shenemar, arm rather. Shenemar ukshar tom leos al yodecha. You shall tie them as a sign upon your hand. Uva perush al zeh mikra shenikshor al yodenu midivrei Torah arba parshios. That the received interpretation of this the commandment is that you have to put certain parts of the Torah in a box and tie it on your hand, literally. In other words, you could have interpreted it potentially figuratively, that the words of the Torah should be a sign on your hand, that you should govern everything you do. But the traditional interpretation that Chazal tell us is that it means that you actually have to have physical things that you tie on your hand. V'hei nikros tefillin. These are called tefillin. Kishen kishuros beretzuos. They're tied with straps. Kimu sheba kabola ben. Beilu en arba parshios. Which are the parshios that are in tefillin? Shtayim mehem besof seder bo'el paro. The two last paragraphs of parshios bo. Bein parshios kadesh likol bechor. Ad v'shomar toas achukazos. Lemo adoh miyamim yamima. Shehi parsha achas bechol sefer meduyak. In all the accurate svarim, it's one paragraph, and apparently there were some less accurate traditions where it was broken into two paragraphs. So those paragraphs both mention the words of the Torah being tied on one's hand and on one's head. Uvesof seder v'aschanan, the same thing on the end of Parshas Aschanan, b'sefer el advarim, Parshas Shema Yisrael, same thing. Adu visharecha parsha shlishis. That's the third paragraph of the parsha Shema. Uvesof seder v'haya ikev parshas v'yayim shamoa tishme'u ad l'seislam kimei ha-shamayim al-horeth parsha revias. Those are the four parshias of the tefillin. Arba parshas elu ksuvim b'klaf echad. They're all written on one piece of klaf, which is, klaf is not really parchment. If you can see my article, we'll talk about that a little bit more later. V'golo kemin sefer Torah misofa litchila. So you roll up these parshias from end to beginning, meaning that you should be able to just open it and start reading for each paragraph from the beginning. Umanicho bevayis shel or. Then, again, we're talking about the shel yad here, so there's only one compartment that you put it in. So you write them all on one piece of cloth, and then you stick it in leather housing. are actually not properly called leather, because leather means tanned leather, but we actually, the batim nowadays are made of rawhide. They're just processed with lime, and it's still hard. Leather is much softer. Umavir bikzeha or ritzua achas, and then you put a strap through the edge of the leather. The kosher also orsha parshas besochwa zura small, and you tie the paragraph on your left arm. How are you gonna take that? You're not gonna fight back?
I was gonna say, I guess if you're right. Mm-hmm. Most people do it on their left hand, but if you're left-handed, you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Now, regarding the order of the parshios.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, famously, of course, Rashi and Tosafos, you know, the degree. But before Rashi and Tosafos, there must have been somebody must have said something about which order they're supposed to be.
The machlokes between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. We call it Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's really much, much older. That famously, Rashi holds that the order of the parashas and tefillin are in the order that they appear in the Chumash. So, Kaddish li v'yaki v'yacha shma v'yam shamoa. That according to Rabbeinu Tam, it's Kaddish v'yaki v'yacha v'yam shamoa shma. The shma goes at the end, and the two parashas that begin v'haya are in the middle. Together. The two v'hayas are together, which is based on a reading of the Gemara Maseches Menachos, where it talks about the tefillin. So why is it talking about tefillin Maseches Menachos? Because Menachos, they're talking about which parts are crucial and prevent the mitzvah from being fulfilled. So then it goes into all the parshas of the tefillin are ma'akev each other, and all the both parshas of the mezuzah are ma'akev each other. They don't have all of the text of the tefillin and mezuzah, so you're not yotzei. And then it says the tzitzis, the four tzitzis are ma'akev each other. They have all four tzitzis. You shouldn't just put three tzitzis on the garment, so that's ma'akev each other. But then it says hatchilas eino ma'akev es alavan, that if you still have tchilas, you still have lavan. Rabbi disagrees. Okay, fine. So the Gemara Masechet Menachos is talking about the order of the parshias, and it's implied in other places in Shas as well. And it's a huge, huge machlokes. So Rabbeinu Tam, some say also, by the way, that Rabbeinu Tam only disagrees about the order in the Shel Rosh and not in the Shel Yad. Mm-hmm. Because in the Shel Yad, it's all written on one klaf, and in fact, the rule is that it could, that's not makiv. The Ar Tanaim, the hold it is, but we paskin that even if you wrote the four parashas in the Shel Yad on four different klafin, and you stuck it all in one housing, because it's all in one housing, it's good. So some Rishonim say, well, how could the order matter for the Shel Yad? You could write them on all four klafin, on four different klafin. Mm-hmm. So even if they're all in one klaf, just imagine it chopped up and rearranged. Mm-hmm. But the Shel Rosh, that each are in four specific compartments, so obviously the order does matter, but those who put on Rabbeinu Tam tefillah nowadays are knowing that the order matters even in the Shel Yad. So in fact, this disagreement between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam is an extremely ancient machlokas that is found in the times of the Geonim already, and many, many Rishonim disagree about this issue. That's why it's somewhat misleading to call it Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, because it's they're just examples of a huge difference in of Shita in the Rishonim. So how do we resolve this?
Most people wear Rashi.
Oh, I like your answer. That's an excellent, excellent answer. That's what it says. That most people wear Rashi tefillin. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch brings both Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, and he says Minag Haolam Kirashi. That the general practice is like Rashi. So some people are madaik from this, that the Shulchan Aruch does not rule on the matter.
Uh-huh.
That's why he writes, the Minag is like Rashi, and then he quotes that a Yeresha Mayim, that someone who is very frum should wear both Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam tefillin to be yotzei both shitas. And it says you shouldn't do it unless you're extremely religious, and if you're known and being extremely pious in all your halachic practices, then you can wear Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. So some say that when the Shulchan Aruch says that only someone extremely pious is supposed to wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, that's referring to the original way it was done of both Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, which is that they used to wear both at the same time. they used to have very small tefillin, and they used to put on Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam tefillin at the same time. But some people say that according to the Shulchan Aruch, if you wear them bezeach or zeh, if you wear Rashi tefillin for davening and then Rabbeinu Tam tefillin after davening, so that anyone could do. That you don't have to be... the biyotze the mitzvah, according to Rabbeinu Tam.
Oh, you mean put them on and take them off, not wear them all day.
Nobody would know.
Right.
Nobody
so
does that
very few. Some people do actually.
So few people wear. I mean, the original way is that tefillin are supposed to be worn all day, but now we limit it to davening. Yeah.
Was there any Sephardic custom? No. Well, the Shulchan Aruch is really from Rabbi Caro, right?
So the
Sephardim didn't have a separate custom.
The Rambam writes. Well, first of all, the Ramban and the Rashba agree with Rashi. So that's Sephardi.
Yeah.
But there are other Sephardim showing him that that they agree with Rabbi Tam. And in fact. Oh. The Rambam writes in a tshuva that in Spain he used to have Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. He doesn't call it Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, but he says he used to have Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. Oh. And then when he moved to Egypt, so he got access to more accurate manuscripts of the Gemara and of Geonic literature and practices of the Geonim, and he switched. Because he was convinced that the correct order was like Rashi. And that's the way he paskins in the Mishnah Torah, that the order of the parashas and tefillin is like Rashi, yeah?
So wait a second. Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, is one of them correct and the other one incorrect in terms of like whether you're Yotzei there? Are they Makay of each one and the other?
Yeah, so the Gemara says, Hichlif Parashio Seh Psulos. If you put them in the wrong order, the tefillin are no good, which is why many people, starting with the Maharam and the Rush, used to wear both, or at least they used to wear it together, but at least one after the other. So famously, the Vilna Gaon wore only Rashi tefillin. It would be more interesting if he had worn only Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, but he wore only Rashi tefillin. So his student, he saw that his student Reb Chaim Volozhiner wore Rabbeinu Tam tefillin after davening. So the Vilna Gaon asked him, "Why are you wearing Rabbeinu Tam tefillin?" So Reb Chaim Volozhiner said, "Well, I understand you wear tefillin all day long, so you hold that the main shita is like Rashi." So you don't want to, if you put on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, that would be that you would spend a few minutes a day, according to you, not wearing tefillin. But me, I don't wear tefillin all day long, so what does it matter? I put on Rashi for davening, and then Rabbeinu Tam after davening. What's the big deal?
Put them on and then take them off.
So yeah, so Rabbeinu Tam, so the Vilna Gaon responded, if you really want to be Yotzei every shita on tefillin, you have to wear 64 pairs of tefillin. Because there are different shitas that some hold that the parsha break should be different, and some hold the parsha should be lying down. So if you want, you have to have Rashi lying down or Rabbeinu Tam lying down, and the different parsha break Rashi or Rabbeinu Tam. So by the time you geometrically multiply everything, you have to wear 64 pairs of tefillin. The truth is, there are more than that. If you really have every permutation, it would really be more than 64 pairs of tefillin. But the Vilna Gaon held b'shita that one should not wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. That raises the question. So why is the minag to be choshesh for... there's another shita, by the way. The other shita is about how you should put in the parashas of tefillin. That the Rivet holds like Rabbeinu Tam in reverse.
Oh, okay.
That Rabbeinu Tam holds that it goes... Kadesh v'yakiv yachav v'yayim shemo ashma. So they're going from, if you're looking at the person who's wearing tefillin, from right to left. But but the Rivet holds like Rabbeinu Tam, but the opposite direction. That it goes from right to left of the person wearing the tefillin, not the person looking at Rabbeinu Tam, of that. So, and then there's a sheet, some say that there's a sheet of the Shimusha Rabba that holds like Rashi backwards. So it's not so clear that that exists, but okay. Some hold like that. So there really are more sheetas about that. There are many sheetas about wearing tefillin. So the Noda Bihuda as a tshuva, why are we choshesh for Rabbeinu Tam, and not all of Rabbeinu Tam shittas about how to make tefillin? Mm-hmm. He might hold that the parsha should be in a different position, or that the ink should be different. So we call it Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, but these Rabbeinu Tam tefillin don't even fulfill the shita of Rabbeinu Tam necessarily about how tefillin should be made. So why is this our minhag that we're choshesh only for the order of the parshias? So Noda Bihuda explains, very important yesod, that as I was saying before, if you look in the Rishonim, the machlokes of the order of the parashas and tefillin between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam is almost a 50-50 split. So because everybody is so hard, thinks that everybody wears Rashi, so we then think, oh, it must be that just the minority Shita holds like Rabbeinu Tam. Really, it's almost a 50-50 split about the order. So that's why. But the other issues have been basically resolved much more. So that's why the Noda Behuda writes that the very strong practice of Klal Yisrael is that those are the only things we are choshish for, Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam Tefillah. So different communities have different approaches to wearing Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. So the Zohar says, by the way, as interpreted by the Arizal, it's a huge Kiddush, by the way, he says, no, it's not that there's a machlokas about which is the correct tefillin. It's that everybody agrees you have to wear both. No. Obviously, that's not the simple understanding. So that's why, according to this school of Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic understanding, if you don't wear both Rashi or Beinu Tan Tefillin, you're missing something in the mitzvah of Tefillin, for sure. So that's why more Kabbalistically oriented communities are much more into Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. That in Hasidic communities, basically every after your marriage, so that's probably like your chasen shatz. Chasen shatz. So your father-in-law gets you a chasen shatz, and he gets you chasen Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin.
I mean, before you're married, doesn't make any difference. I mean, how does that make it? Hey, when you know?
Oh, the idea is that it's since Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin are extremely holy at PLP Kabbalah. So before you're married, between bar mitzvah and marriage, you know, we're going to learn that you're supposed to have a pure mind and soul while you're wearing tefillin. So while you're not married, you're more likely to have improper thoughts while wearing tefillin in general, and Rabbeinu Tam tefillin in particular, which is worse. So in Chabad, they wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin after bar mitzvah, which is, I heard, a new thing that... the last Rebbe instituted it in one of his shmuzin somehow, and everybody started doing it. Whatever it is, so usually it starts at marriage, which is interesting. So that's Kabbalistic things. In certain Hasidic sects, they only start after marriage. That's why we'll talk about Tefillin L'Chol HaMoed. No. So we'll talk about Tefillin L'Chol HaMoed. So in Sadmer, I think, the Bachrim wear Tefillin L'Chol HaMoed. And after you're married, you stop wearing tefillin l'chol hamoed. Why? Because the halacha really is you do wear tefillin l'chol hamoed. But we'll discuss whether that's the case. Okay, whatever. According to the Ashkenazi psak, you really do wear tefillin l'chol hamoed. But it's al pi kabbalah you don't wear tefillin l'chol hamoed. So therefore, you're only supposed to do that. Only supposed to do kabbalistic practices after you got married. So in most communities, in Hasidic communities and Sephardic communities as well, most Sephardic communities. It's extremely common for even regular Balabatisha Jews to wear Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. You should look in why you daven, why you allow a Sfardim there. So it's almost everyone, almost every married Sfardi you see after davening is taking off the Rashi Tefillin and putting on Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. So since it's become a common thing, so it's no longer called a Yuhara, that if you do something that looks overly pious, if it doesn't really correspond to your general comportment, that's called Yuhara. Haughtiness. So therefore, once it's become common in a community, so we don't. It's not called URA.
Sorry, basic really newbie question.
Yeah.
Can you tell from just looking at them which one are the Rashi and which one are the Rabbeinu Tam?
Officially, no. But the Sofrim invented a way to distinguish between the two, at least for the Shel Rosh, which is that if you look, there are little hairs sticking out of. So some of we'll discuss that the Parshias inside are wrapped in hair. So you stay the Pi the Zohar. We stick some of the hair out of the tefillin so you can see it on the outside through one of the holes that you use for sewing them shut. Okay. So you stick it out of a different hole for Rashi tefillin and for Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. So, yeah.
I was
going to
ask, do the Taimanim or other groups that may not have been affected by this question, do they have their own way?
I mean, Taimanim originally wore only Rashi tefillin because they followed everything up in the Rambam, but as Kabbalah gained more of an influence in many circles in Yemen, so they started wearing Rabbeinu Tam tefillin even in Yemen. So, but among non-Hasidic Jews, so the general practice, nowadays, again, there are people who are machmer and saying no one, but the general practice is that one only starts wearing Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin at a goodly advanced age. Like the Chofetz Chaim, I think, started wearing Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin when he was in his 80s. Rav Moshe Feinstein started wearing Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin again when
he
was
in the Lubavitcher Rebbe gave him one.
Yeah. Right, the Lubavitcher Rebbe wanted him to wear Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin, so he gave him a pair of Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. Yes, and the sofer, the Lubavitcher Rebbe's personal sofer, sat with Rav Moshe Feinstein, getting him exact specifications how he wanted. So Rav Moshe Feinstein started wearing it later. The Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, also in his 80s or 90s, started wearing Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. So that's the general practice. So that's at least publicly. Again, I don't think they wore it at all before, but...
in addition or instead?
They wore... Because the tefillin nowadays are bigger, so you can't really wear Rav Asher Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin at the same time unless you get specially made tiny tefillin.
No, but I mean, take them off and put... I mean,
normally what you do is you take them off after davening and then you
without a bracha.
You put on without a bracha afterwards.
A bracha.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Have you ever written Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin?
Yeah, but it's also a shaila whether someone who doesn't wear Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin is supposed to write Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin.
Okay. Uh-huh.
That so will that what? Someone who is
it's not
right. So
like
some
women.
Right. So women cannot write tefillin, but the same thing extends to someone who is like. Mummer l'tfillin. That somebody who does b'shita doesn't wear tefillin is also puzzled to write tefillin. So that's the shiloh whether someone. So some poskim hold that if you don't wear Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin, you're not allowed to write Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin because vis-a-vis the Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin, you are against it. You don't wear it. It's a little bit shver because it's not really that you're against it. It's just you haven't done it yet. But again, people. In non-Hasidic communities, if you want to wear Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin, so generally it wouldn't be done in shul after davening. You would be put it on in private. But it's a very interesting historical halachic practice.